Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan McLeod. Now, when I interviewed SensePost CTO Dominic White a month or two back, he kindly agreed to jump onto this podcast again for a chat when major InfoSec issues happen. And they certainly have happened this past week, to help give us a bit of the sober context of what goes on in this space. And he's kindly agreed to jump onto this onto a Skype call with me this afternoon, all the way from London, to talk about what one government official has called the biggest cyber attack in history. And that's, of course, the ransomware called WannaCry, which has reportedly affected hundreds of thousands of Windows-based computers around the world. Dominic, thank you for joining us all the way from London today.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Duncan.
First of all, Dominic, is WannaCry as big a deal as is being made out by politicians, by the antivirus companies, and by the media?
There's two answers to that question. So technically, I don't think it is. SMB worms have been around for a long time. In the early 2000s, 2004, 2005, we had massive outbreaks of SMB worms, or worms spreading through things like SQL Slammer was a famous one. So we've seen worms that have taken over large parts of the planet before. Malware has been spreading on internal networks using SMB connections, things like Conficker, which was 2008, specifically was using exploits in SMB, the Microsoft file sharing protocol, and it had a big breakout too. And then we've even seen for a long time there's been malware that has, they try and guess passwords to administrative shares on machines and spreads that way. So that kind of thing's been around. We know ransomware has been around for a long time. Lots of people are affected by ransomware. So it's really the combination of those things happening together that has made this big. And the important thing to remember about ransomware is we know when a machine gets infected. Mm. So hypothetically, if they've been spreading some malware that would allow them to remotely monitor a machine covertly and then scraping credit card details out of this, we might not have seen how big the infection was. So what that means is it feeds into the hype cycle. People see their machines go down, they're disabled, they're not working. So there's a lot more hype about this. In terms of the actual number of infected machines, unfortunately, I don't have them off the top of my head, but even then, it's difficult to track. So the guy who registered the first sinkhole domain, which we can get to the technical stuff in a while, was able to track infections connecting back to that. I'm not sure of the numbers he saw, but there's also other variants. People can make changes to this and put those out, and I'm not sure how many connections those would have had. So on a pure numbers level, I'm not sure it's the biggest we've seen, but I stand corrected if that's not the case. I suspect it's more the hype that people saw their machines getting infected and their machines were disabled and prevented from working.
I suppose you're right. When this stuff happens silently and it's for surveillance purposes rather than trying to extort money from people, often people don't even know that their machines are infected. This is a very deliberate thing that they want to extort money from you, and you know that your machine is infected because it tells you it's infected.
Yeah. Hmm. And then funny enough, that wasn't even particularly successful. I think at one point, it's probably a bit more now, they managed to collect something like the equivalent of $30,000.
I saw that.
This clunky manual process to actually get your keys back.
Yeah. Do you think the guys behind this were fairly amateurish? I mean, there have been suggestions that the fact that they've only collected a few tens of thousands of dollars from this, despite infecting hundreds of and reported hundreds of thousands of machines, does it suggest that they didn't really know what they were doing?
I'm always loath to make comments about what the people behind things really were like. But they used a public exploit from that NSA dump. You know, it wasn't their own unique work. Mm. They used ransomware, which would imply they're trying to get money out of it. I mean, if they wanted to just disable machines, they could have had a simpler payload. Mm. And if they wanted to do the stealthy covert stuff, they could have there's other public payloads there. So it would imply it's somewhat amateurish. There's kind of a hobby horse of the industry is to try and guess, you know, is this one group trying to do something? Is this somebody trying to make the NSA look bad with the leaks, or is this somebody trying to make Microsoft look bad and the ransomware was plausible deniability? Because if they were really, if they were amateurish and doing it for the money, you'd still think they would have tried to collect some of the money. But that manual process seemed broken. Or maybe they just saw the hype and went, whoops, that way so that they didn't get arrested. But yeah, it certainly doesn't look, but nothing of that indicated a well-polished professional group.
And the fact that the person who helped really stop the spread of this thing did it simply by registering a URL, just explain how that worked, Dominic, and why was it so easy to do that?
So when malware analysts review malware, so this means load it up in a sandbox and they fire up tools which allow them to inspect the workings, the inner workings of this. And this is a common thing that hundreds of, if not thousands of people all over the world do very regularly. Symantec and McAfee and the other antivirus companies have teams that do this. They reverse engineer malware. We call it reversing for short. Try and find out what it's doing so they can write signatures or they could build other detections. He was idly doing that, and so in his words, he said he was on holiday and just decided to have a quick look at it. And it's part of his common process to register any domains that show up in the code, just proactively.
Oh, okay.
And the reason they do that is to try and track the number of infections. If we can get every new infected instance to send some kind of ping up to a server, then it means, and we control that server, it means we can track the number of infections. Additionally, maybe there's going to be an opportunity at a later stage to try and push notification down to people to fix things or even uninfect them. So that's kind of a proactive thing they did. He didn't know it was going to have the effect that it did have to effectively kill the malware. His supposition is that it wasn't built as a kill switch. This was an attempt by the malware authors to build analysis evasion into their code. If the malware is running on a real machine, this domain won't exist and it'll continue. But if it's running on a malware analyst sandbox, which is going to have a fake view of the internet, then all of the domains are going to exist. So viruses will do all sorts of, well, malware will try and do all sorts of tricks to try and work out if they're in a sandbox. You know, is this a VMware machine? Do all domains resolve to the same IP address, which would imply it's being captured. So his belief is that this was an attempt to detect analysis, some random domain that malware author knows doesn't exist. The second that started existing, this malware the world over thought it was in a sandbox and exited to prevent analysis, which is just sort of poorly written malware. We don't know that's the case, but we hope.
You mentioned Microsoft, potentially this was an attempt to discredit them in some way. And I know that's speculation, but this malware has specifically affected Windows computers that hadn't been patched with a patch that Microsoft had released back in March of this year. There's been a lot of accusations flying around on various websites suggesting that the NSA is to blame for this. In fact, Microsoft's Brad Smith specifically pointed fingers at the NSA. Others have suggested that maybe Microsoft needs to be criticized for not being more proactive than it is enforcing updates on end users. If there is going to be finger pointing here, Dominic, where do you think the fingers should really be pointed?
Well, the reason this is such a hotbed of debate is because there's no easy answers here. So what it goes down to is the fundamental question is, should software authors be responsible for vulnerabilities in their code? In the same way that a car manufacturer would be responsible for problems in theirs. The problem with that is that would imply, so if there was some legislation put in place making software developers responsible for flaws in their code, that would imply that we would need to carry the costs of shipping code that had gone through extensive security testing. It means all of the software automatically gets more expensive. So as consumers, I'm not sure we want to necessarily pay. We're kind of okay with having some level of insecurity as long as there's some process to have it checked and fixed over time, which is Microsoft done with their patching process. And arguably, Microsoft has invested a lot into making sure that their new stuff is more and more secure, which is one of the reasons why, well, I wouldn't say it's one of the reasons why, but this was on older stuff. It was the SMB version 1 protocol and on older machines. I've seen some people claiming that Windows 10 can be vulnerable to this. You just need to update the exploit for that. That's conjecture. I haven't seen any proof of that yet. So Microsoft's in a tough spot because on the one hand, all software has flaws. I mean, there's sort of laws about this. Academics have come up with research saying, you know, for every 1,000 lines of code, you've got a critical security vulnerability or equivalent. It's not the exact stat. But so if all software is going to have bugs in it, then Microsoft's got this duty to sort of find them and patch them. They've got this patch cycle, and they do that. And that's kind of the general responsibility of all software providers around the world. When a vulnerability is reported to you, issue a patch, make sure they're tested and they work well and people can apply them. That's the patch treadmill everyone's on. So arguably Microsoft did their job here. And at the moment, we don't hold software vendors liable for vulnerabilities in their product. If we did, then it's going to be much bigger than just Microsoft. And it's Google for Chrome, and it's Mozilla for Firefox, and it's Adobe for Adobe PDF, and, you know, SARS for their tax e-filing application. You know, this would be the world over. It'd be very difficult legislation to enact, hard to enforce the world over. So outside of what you'd like to do, there's some practicalities to it. So then the next finger pointing is to the NSA. So if software developers aren't vulnerable or aren't liable for holes in their code, then the people who find the vulnerabilities, or even more, the people who write exploits for these should be held liable, as the argument would go. Mm. And bear in mind, there's a big difference between finding a vulnerability and writing an exploit. And in the case of something like Microsoft Windows, that's an increasingly large gap, because Microsoft has put exploit protections in place in their operating system to make it hard to go from just a vulnerability to a full code execution exploit. Mm. So that means somebody put time and effort into building this. And we know who that is. It was the NSA or the Equation Group, whose stash got stolen by shadow brokers and put out there. Now, if you're going to say, well, the NSA is to blame for this, that's got two problems. The first is, if we're going to blame exploit writers, we start talking about code as a weapon rather than code as a form of protected speech. And that's had all sorts of problems historically. So historically, the U.S. government classified crypto as a munition. Mm. And that was where, you know, the DVD industry used that stuff to try and zone lock DVDs. And it kind of messed with consumer freedom and ability to use the stuff you had in favor of, you know, corporates protecting their bottom line at your expense. So I think that cuts both ways in the way that you don't want. And then as a researcher myself, or even as a developer, if you're writing code, if your code is no longer declared a form of protected free speech, inverted commas, but now it can be declared a munition or something else, that's going to have real implications on all sorts of places there. So we don't want, you know, people propose things like a global Cyber Geneva Convention. Mm. You know, it's actually a really complex idea riddled with all sorts of very difficult to enact things. So then the next part of this is, well, if we're going to blame the NSA for having tools that allow them to conduct their mission, you know, you can argue that places like the NSA shouldn't exist. But if we sort of acknowledge the fact we live in a world where intelligence agencies exist and have a job to do, then if it's not the NSA and we imagine it was South Africa, the South African government, does the South African government have a right to use tools to conduct their mission? And are we going to differentiate cyber weapons, which is I use somewhat sarcastically because I do think code is speech, from, you know, cell phone listening devices, you know, or other forms of technology, or even just human intelligence that allow them to conduct their mission. You know, as a South African citizen, I want the South African law enforcement or intelligence agencies to be able to do their mission. Likewise, American citizens would want the NSA to do their own mission. So if we can't blame Microsoft because blaming software vendors for vulnerabilities in their code is difficult, and we can't blame exploit writers because we want code to be a protected form of speech, and we can't blame intelligence agencies for doing their job, then what we're left with really is we can blame an intelligence agency for losing control of something that was theirs. So if the SSA left their cell phone catches standing in the middle of the street and criminals picked these up and started using them, arguably the failure there would be that the SSA left that stuff uncontrolled. So likewise, the fact that somebody like the NSA had this stuff, the stuff got out into the world. If somebody had lost control of their nuclear arsenal, not that it's anywhere near the same thing, you would blame them for not having controls in place enough to protect it. So the failing here was the NSA got breached somehow, or that Asian group got breached somehow. It's difficult to put too much blame on there because that's a shadowy world I don't understand, and there's a lot of misinformation about that. But that's kind of where I'm left. I take some personal positions on those three areas that we spoke about, but I figure we're not here to talk about my personal opinions.
Well, I'd love to hear your personal views on it. But what about, Dominic, what about end users? What is their responsibility here? I mean, this happened because these machines had not been patched, or they were running outdated operating systems like Windows XP, which hasn't been supported officially by Microsoft, I think, for three years now. How much blame should we be pointing at the end users, the companies that own this infrastructure that hasn't been updated?
Again, let me give the both sides view. On the one hand, we can say, oh, end users didn't patch. You're stupid and it's your own fault. On the other hand, in some cases, that's true. People are just lazy and didn't get around to it, or careless or negligent. But in a lot of cases, there's a reason why those things are still running. So if we take SCADA equipment as an example, a lot of the time, manufacturers of big manufacturing systems, you know, crushers and steamers and boilers, they're running some version of Windows XP, which has been certified to work with this thing. And bear in mind, human life comes into play here. And if these things go wrong, there's explosions and things get smashed. Now, every time a patch comes out, they've got to recertify that this thing's not going to blow up or kill someone in the same way. And that's quite expensive and it's quite a lot of work, so they don't. So you'll often see in the mines, in the breweries, in all sorts of manufacturing places, you've got these old Windows XP machines running these things. They can't patch. If they patch, they'll be uncertified to run these. Then there's other places, so arguably hospitals which have bone cutters controlled by a certain version of Windows 7 that hasn't been updated. Again, you can't just apply patches there. So in some cases, there's real reasons why you can't apply patches. But then you can say, well, those things should be separated from the network, so they're not available on the public internet to be scanned and affected by you. So there are mitigating controls you can put in place. But it starts to get into the question of why isn't stuff secure in the first place? And it just comes down to time, money, expertise, global shortages of those expertise, different, not everybody having enough money, not everybody's mission being security focused. And so there's, consultants and hackers and maybe idle observers love to blame people for not patching. But if we look at this differently, what if it was what we would call a zero day? So that means a vulnerability which nobody knew about until it was released. So there was no patch from Microsoft. And the same thing could have happened. The exact same thing could have happened, but you wouldn't have had the luxury of blaming users for not patching. So I think people who were negligent in not patching, Microsoft has been running their patching cycle second Tuesday of every month for years now. I think we're over a decade. If you're responsible for looking after Windows machines and you're not doing that on things which can take patches, then you've been negligent and you deserve some blame. If you've got SMB exposed to the public internet and there isn't a very good reason why, then you're being negligent. You've got that to blame. But I feel a lot of sympathy for people on the edge cases of all of that.
The NSA has been hoarding these vulnerabilities, and I'm sure it's not the only intelligence agency to be doing that. Do you think we need legislation that forces everyone, companies, intelligence organizations, governments, whoever it happens to be, to disclose vulnerabilities to the companies that develop that software when they discover them? Do you think we need laws that force that to stop this hoarding behavior that we've seen at the NSA, for example? Would that help?
It would help one side of that argument. But so hypothetically, there's lots of people who need those things to do their job. So in some cases, it might be a job you disagree with in the form of intelligence agencies. In other cases, it might be a job you disagree with less, something like law enforcement. And so while somebody might say, well, if law enforcement's using this stuff inappropriately on, investigating political opponents, that's inappropriate. But if they were using it to dismantle a kiddie porn ring, suddenly we're behind it. There's some people who have legitimate reasons to do their job. Somebody like me in our organization, we need to be able to demonstrate to our customers that we can get that things like 0 days exist, that there are compromises that they haven't heard of. And if it takes us time and money to develop these things, and if we're just giving them to the vendor every time, then we're going to have to be spending a lot of time and money to demonstrate that, and that's a cost that real adversaries don't have to bear. So truthfully, that's what we end up doing. We don't hoard vulnerabilities internally, and that's why I can talk about why that cost is uncomfortable. And then outside of all of that, I think there's kind of a freedom aspect. People should be, if you believe people should be free to do with their electronics and software as they want, rather than as the corporate who built it wants. So there's a difference between your iPhone being licensed to you from Apple rather than you owning it. Then something like an exploit, for which would practically is what a jailbreak is, becomes about freeing that device from controls that you aren't happy with as a consumer. So I think there's legitimate reasons to allow security research and have these things to exist. But hoarding full exploit code, so different from a vulnerability right to an exploit, I think generally ends up as a moral harm. And there's probably enough nuanced examples out there that you could start putting something together that says, hey, NSA, if you lose control of your stash, report those to the vendors immediately to get fixed, which they did eventually. I think there's some debate about whether they did that fast enough. So you don't have to say, look, the NSA can't do its job using exploits and cripple it. You can just say you need to have put in a lot of work to protect them and to monitor if those things get out. And if at any point you think those things get burned, you need to release it. I also think you can probably limit how much they have. So the NSA doesn't need 800 exploits, one or two really solid ones against that work across most Windows infrastructure would work for them. So over time, they can retire these and feed them back to Microsoft to get patched.
I was interested that Microsoft decided through this process, I think it was last Friday or last Saturday, to issue an emergency patch, if I can call it that, for Windows XP, which, as I said, hasn't been supported generally anyway for the past 3 years. What did you make of that decision by Microsoft? And do you think it's now created expectations amongst people? And do you think there's an expectation now that Microsoft will release patches if there's a serious security vulnerability, even though that software is so old?
So Microsoft is working very hard to make sure that's not an expectation. So that patch, they didn't build it especially for this. As far as I understand it, they've got an end-of-life support product that you can buy.
Yes.
I think it's quite expensive, but for large companies that still have to run XP, they can buy this extended support, and which means they developed this patch
anyway.
And so the timestamps on the patch supposedly were, I think it was February the 11th is when the patch had been developed, which implies they built this patch long before WannaCry came out, and they were just releasing it. The next question is, well, why don't you just release all of your end-of-life patches all the time so that stuff doesn't happen? And I'm guessing they'd say, because we want people to stop using Windows XP and move to our new... I think there's many reasons they'd want people to move, but from a security point of view, those things are better hardened and have better security.
Okay. So I was interested as well about the use of Bitcoin in this whole process. I was reading an interesting article this morning actually saying that it's going to be very difficult for the people behind this to actually cash that out into non-Bitcoin currency, because there's so many eyes on them at the moment, and the moment they try and do that, they'll probably be caught. What's sort of, maybe just talk us through the role that Bitcoin has played in this whole thing, and do you think the existence of I'll call it a relatively anonymous cryptocurrency like Bitcoin actually facilitates the spread of malware like this?
I think it's a bit of a red herring. I think you know, if it wasn't Bitcoin, it would be Western Union or some other way of transferring money. There's probably a way you could even use credit cards for this before your merchant account gets shut down. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always going to be a way to transfer money. And arguably, what's weird to me about criminals using Bitcoin is that Bitcoin is not anonymous. It has an incredibly strong sense of identity to the point that the crypto bakes that into the blockchain, which is why you can follow transactions. What it does have, though, is a deassociation of identity to your personal identity from the account. So it's not like a Bitcoin wallet ID is my name. It's not Dominic. It's just a wallet. And so as far as I understand it, and I'm not a Bitcoin aficionado by any means, I've never personally owned Bitcoin, which I'm sure lots of people are reeling in horror at the thought of. But just really to say, like, I think there's people with much more authority who can speak on this.
Sure.
But as far as I understand it, the way people get money out is to use these tumblers, which are effectively algorithms that spin the money very quickly through all sorts of accounts and all sorts of different ways to try and evade tracking. I get the idea that's a bit of an arms race on how to track those algorithms and counter algorithms. But surely at some level there is a baked in crypto audit trail that allow them to follow this. And so when they want to get the money out, that becomes difficult. But arguably SARS, if that's possible, then SARS could equally track people's money in Bitcoin in the first place. So I think it's really just the disassociation of identity, your personal identity from that. So it only gets a personal identity once it's paid out into another bank account. There's probably enough places to do that don't have detailed tracking. But yeah, no, I'm really just spinning yarn at this point. I don't know what I don't know there.
Sure.
But sure. Yeah, so I don't think Bitcoin facilitates crime. I think it's easier to use internet currency, and it's got less of the sort of in-country regulations on it, which help. But I don't think Bitcoin itself makes crime possible. And sort of trying to put that on Bitcoin, I think, would be a bit unfair.
Okay. Now, we saw the politicians jumping on this one, particularly in the UK, where the National Health Service was particularly affected by this particular ransomware. Dominic, do you think there's anything governments can actually do, should be doing, to try to mitigate this stuff?
I think there's a lot governments could do, but the first instinct is to legislate, and I think that's really dangerous and cuts both ways, and it's going to be years of case law before we maybe get something actually usable. I think the kinds of things government can do is assist people in being less vulnerable to this. Mm. So, you know, the NHS needs more money, I suspect, for information security professionals who can help set that network up and run it. Governments can probably set up, several have, internal computer security emergency response teams or computer security incident response teams, CSERTs, that could proactively scan the country's networks looking for exposed vulnerabilities, contact those organizations, walk them through how to defend themselves, how to put processes in place to make sure these things don't show up in future, run education programs, subsidize education material, development of education material, provide funding to groups working on defensive solutions for these things in country. You know, that could probably come out of an innovation budget that would encourage some of that cyber money from flowing into your country anyway. So I think there's all sorts of ways you can do it through there, but that the default instinct to legislate is probably the most dangerous. It's much easier to pass a law than actually try and change I guess the way things are set up.
So we need more carrot and less stick, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think we're missing a lot of carrot, and as they clean up all their machines, I think they're only experiencing stick. They don't need more sticks on top of that.
Yeah. So just to wrap up, Dominic, for individuals, for a home user who's got a computer at home, what is the most important thing he needs to know here? Is it that he should update his operating system when Windows asks for an update to be installed? Don't ignore it, for example. Is that the best practice here, or are there other things that they should do to avoid ransomware?
Yeah, look, I think there's sort of those trite basics that everyone should be doing. Make sure your computer's configured for automatic updates. Automatic, you know, not, you don't want to be sitting there approving it. Don't get in the way of it applying those updates. And for all of your software, not just base Windows, make sure your antivirus is up to date. Periodically have it scan your whole computer. Don't ignore alerts, things like that. Mm. I think practically, things like ransomware point to the fact that you need decent backups. I think if you're over the age of probably 20 these days, you've had a computer system fail on you at least once, enough to justify backups for important stuff anyway, not just because of ransomware. And then the trick is to just make sure that those backups don't end up getting infected with ransomware too. Mm. So you don't want, if you've got an external hard drive that you're backing stuff up to and you plug it into a ransomware infected machine, it'll then happily ransomware encrypt everything on your external hard drive. So you've kind of got to put some thought into making sure that the execution environment of your machine doesn't have full file system access to your backup media. Which is a slightly harder problem for, I think, consumers to solve. For organizations, they've got big, fancy backup solutions, which effectively do that. I guess that's really the thing for consumers. Make you less likely to get the ransomware and then give you more ability to clean up with it afterwards. But like I said, at least the nice thing with ransomware is it tells you when it's there.
Yes, it announces itself. Dominic, just lastly, and I think it's quite an interesting one. We actually spoke about it last time we recorded a podcast, and that's the issue of perhaps people in developing markets being more disadvantaged than people in developed markets. I mean, you and I, for example, I'm sure you have fiber at home. You patch your computer. You just don't think about it. You do it. Many people are reliant on a mobile data connection. They're using Android. That Android is often out of date. The phone is probably bugging them to install a 1 gig update on their device. They're saying no because they can't afford that mobile data. Given this case and other information security issues more generally, do you think there's a argument to be made perhaps that it's a responsibility of service providers, internet service providers, telecommunications operators to zero rate security updates for end users?
I think it's such an obvious thing to do that arguably somebody should do it just for a competitive advantage. Say, hey, our network does it, the others don't, you should use us because of it. And I think there's ways they can be really clever about it. They can pull the patches down onto their network and then just redistribute it over their network so it's not international bandwidth pulling down. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of people who've got a lot more insight into how those things are run who are going, that's a terrible idea, and there's reasons. But if somebody like Facebook can work with the likes of the cellular networks to zero-rate some of their data, then I'm fairly sure that somebody like Microsoft could also work with some of those networks to zero-rate their patch data. I think that should be true. The problem is that's not the only thing stopping these updates. So, for example, people buying cheaper phones have less space on their phone. So they can't apply the Android update because they'd have to delete all of their WhatsApp pictures or something like that, which means they're less likely to put the thing on there. So I think it's not just a matter of bandwidth. There's, you know, old Android devices or cheap Android devices don't get patches, and that sort of Google hasn't really resolved the problems in the ecosystem around that historically. I think they're putting some stuff in for future. And so I think there's lots of reasons why poorer people end up with less security on their device, and not just for network issues.
Interesting. Dominic, thank you so much for joining us all the way from London today. Dominic White is Chief Technology Officer at SensePost. Always great chatting to you, Dominic, and look forward to chatting to you again sometime.
Thanks, Duncan. Thank you for the time.